This is Festival Showcase, a weekly program exclusively on Aspen Public Radio, where we talk to the musicians, composers, conductors, and the movers and shakers from the Aspen Music Festival and School during the festival season, Fridays at 2:30 p.m. I'm your host, Chris Moore. Funding for Festival Showcase on Aspen Public Radio is generously provided by the Barnard Fain Foundation. Everyone is very excited to know that soprano superstar Renee Fleming and world-class opera conductor Patrick Summers are leading the opera program into a new era in Aspen. We'll start by talking with Alan Fletcher, president of the Aspen Music Festival and School, about this major new development. We'll also talk with Christopher Theophanidis, composer of Drum Circles, which appears on this Sunday's concert program. Then we talk with both harpist Nancy Allen and oboist Elaine Duvas, who play a rarely heard Martin concerto on tonight's concert. Finally, we catch up with violinist Stefan Jakiv, a well-known soloist here in Aspen and also a member of the Junction Trio, which comes to Aspen this Tuesday for a recital. Here's Alan Fletcher. Well, Alan, I have seen Patrick Summers conduct some fantastic operas on many stages. And of course, we have all watched Renee Fleming and her incredible career. Now, in some ways, I think a lot of us know Renee Fleming has a special love for Aspen. Part of her artistic growth took place here, and she just loves the beauty and the outdoors and the exercise and everything else. But can you say a little bit about how you were able to convince a person who can do anything that she wants at this point in her life to choose Aspen to spend a good part of her summer?
Yes, sure. Well, Renee and I have always talked a lot, mm-hmm. and so I knew that she cares very deeply about preparing young people for careers, mm-hmm. and she feels that the business has changed within our lifetimes in a big way, and in some good ways and in some challenging ways, and that there are things that young singers need that maybe she did not need in the same way when she was starting out. Mm-hmm. So she had this point of view, and it actually was pretty easy to show her that the platform that we have in Aspen, the size of the program, the excellence of the program, the history of the program, would be perfect for her to realize her vision of what needs to be given to young people.
Well, we can go back a little bit and talk about that platform because Ed Berkeley was the director way back when Renee was a student. Is that correct?
He was not leading the program in those days, but his first year teaching in Aspen was one of the years that Renee was a student mm-hmm. here. So they mm-hmm. have known each other all that time and have been very close friends through the mm-hmm. years as well.
Tell us what his role is going to be in the context of now with Renee and Patrick.
Well, it's really very similar to what he does now because he will direct our Magic Flute, which is going to be our opening opera next summer. He'll be teaching acting classes for all of the singers, which he does now, mm-hmm. and also preparing the scenes. The Saturday mornings are going to be a little different next year in that we will be including music theater and mm-hmm. also art song and possibly some aria classes, but there will be Saturday master classes from 10 to noon as there are now, and Ed will be taking part.
Now, you said you had a lot of conversations with Renee, and I would love, and I think our audience would love to hear what some of those conversations were, because she could have created such a platform as a teacher in a lot of different places, and she chose Aspen. What were some of the things that she may have told you that got her moving in this direction over this time, however many years it's been?
Sure. I think, as you have already said, a key thing is her love for Aspen and, mm-hmm. and her sense of giving back. So many of the great artists who've been students here really have a determination that they want to give back that experience that mm-hmm. they had to the young people here. Also, it is the size of our program because we are very much larger than other excellent programs like Music Academy of the West or Tanglewood, which are superb, mm-hmm. but they're just much smaller, and so the range and the impact that one has here is greater.
Just having read the press release and also having remembered that Renee Fleming was one of those people who actually had the strength to bicycle all the way up to the Maroon Bells, and you can see her now, obviously a person who takes very, very good care of herself. Mm-hmm. Not only does she carry a good appearance, but she also obviously has an enormous amount of energy and vitality.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that and other things with Renee, because it sounds like she's not just going to teach enunciation or intonation or those right. technical things. There's other factors here.
You know, in our discussions, one of the first things she brought up was the importance of nutrition and mm-hmm. exercise and pacing for young singers, and then how to travel. It sounds possibly prosaic, but it's actually a profound issue for singers, and how to go to a city and go through a 5 to 6 week rehearsal cycle and keep yourself ready to sing and healthy.
So there's that, and then there's the whole marketing aspect. How do you market yourself in this age? And how do people of our generation even know how to market in this new world that is being created by the millennials?
Mm-hmm. When Renee was starting out, there was typically a much larger support system for young singers and someone to say, do this role, don't do that role, go to Germany now, don't go to Germany now, go to Italy, stay in the U.S., go to a small regional company, take a small role with a very important house, or wait until you're ready for a big role at an important house. And there's no single way. It takes a lot of intuition, and it's different from person to person. But she has become such an expert at this, and she's one of those supremely empathetic people who has watched what other people do. And she has a tremendous breadth of experience to bring to young singers, and that's one thing we're gonna give them.
I have seen her work with young singers, and every once in a while they kind of get into a little vapor lock because it's Renee Fleming that's standing up there on the stage. Yeah. Have you seen that, and have you seen how she handles that to kind of break down that iconic thing so that she can just be a teacher, just be a human to human?
You know, a classic thing that Renee does in master classes, and it's completely truthful, she makes herself very vulnerable to the student by saying, I had this problem, or when I had this problem, this is what I did. And you can see on a student's face, first they think, no, you have no problems. You never had problems.
You're Renee Fleming. Right.
But in fact, she has always been enormously analytical about her own voice and what is best for her. And it gives her an ability to be disarming and to say, I know exactly what you're going through, and here's something that might help.
So we are looking forward to next year and maybe just stumbling into Renee at a health food restaurant or something as
well. Yeah, absolutely. She'll be at Whole Foods.
Right. I wanted to say congratulations. You really have outdone yourself by bringing Renee in, and we look forward to next year and what the opera program is going to look like.
Great. Thanks, Chris.
If you've just joined us, this is Festival Showcase, and we've been talking with Aspen Music Festival and School President and CEO Alan Fletcher about next year's new opera program and the dual roles of Renee Fleming and Patrick Summers. Now let's talk with Christopher Theofanidis, composer of Drum Circles, which appears on this Sunday's concert program. Well, Chris, let's jump right into Drum Circles, since that's coming right up. And it's going to be played with a full orchestra here. Is it like a percussion or a four percussion concerto or something? Or?
That's right. For the percussion world, one of the standard ensembles is percussion quartet. And that's kind of mix and match. Sometimes it's all mallet instruments. Sometimes it's a mix of different kinds of instruments. So the idea was to write this for a kind of a standard ensemble quartet featured kind of in the front of the orchestra. But in addition to that, with the orchestra, there are the three percussion within the orchestra, so timpani plus two. So in effect, there are seven percussion that kind of ring the orchestra. And we had the idea of the drum circles as kind of the frame for the piece for that reason.
I have been invited into drum circles. They are both very spiritual and very ecstatic and very energetic. And I'm wondering if you were thinking of this from a kind of a spiritual cultural side or just a drum circle, like we just have this circle of drummers.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. Actually, I'm very prone to kind of going in the spiritual direction with music and art. However, in this case, I was thinking of it literally more as a ring. And the neat thing about that is that, you know, at any moment things can kind of surface and there's dialogue and there's some surround sound and there's all kinds of possibilities. And it's, I think, also a visual feast as well as a sonic one.
Now, you were talking about a standard percussion quartet, but a standard percussion quartet does not include break drums or a typewriter or things like that. First of all, how specific are you about the break drums? Is this a Volkswagen Beetle? Is this a Ford 150?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, the great thing about leaving it to percussionists is they're the most heavily vested in trying to get the most interesting sounds and the most fantastic
that's true.
Things. And talking to percussionist friends, they're always kind of amused when they go into a Home Depot and spend a few hours clanking on things, you know, because they think that that's...
Right.
And people are kind of wondering what's wrong with them. So in this case, I didn't specify the vehicle, but I let them kind of choose, and they usually come up with something pretty good.
And then as far as the typewriter, I mean, I think of, when I hear typewriter, I think, who was it, Leroy Anderson?
That's right, yeah. Right,
did that
exactly.
Wonderful typewriter tune,
right.
that popsy thing.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of typewriter you envision, or is it a more modern
thing? Yeah, you know, it's really funny. So in this piece, there are five movements, and there are a lot of problems with writing a concerto. One is kind of that for a percussion quartet, it's, you know, usually you're looking at one player for a concerto, like a solo violinist,
sure.
And there's a real focus issue. But with the spread of instruments the way they are, it gets a little bit tricky just to maintain kind of focus and interest. So what I did with the five movements is really tried to create five really strong characters and delineate those. And the middle movement is this kind of office scene. They reset, they kind of move up towards the front, and it looks like they're in the middle of some, you know, Mad Men office scene. And so at the center of that is the typewriter from which everything kind of flares out. And it's great fun with the other players that kind of add to this kind of sense of busy office music.
Is that the one that's, how can you smile when you're deep in thought? Is
yes.
That, that movement?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Try to find these kind of Zen titles in a way.
And then one is spirits and drums. This is why I was thinking this had a right. spiritual quality, yeah. because you use terms, sparks and chants, yeah. anthems. You use
right.
terms like that in yeah. your subtitles, but you're right. still saying, no, I'm just really thinking of this as a percussion concerto.
I did. I mean, I will say one thing about that particular movement, the spirits and drums, is that, you know, one of the things of the drum circle, of course, is it's drumming primarily. And so I didn't want to ignore that aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that movement probably has the kind of darkest spirit energy. The rest of the mm-hmm. movements have a kind of really extroverted, positive kind of thing. And so I suppose maybe that movement has something of that in there. It does not bright, sunny music, but the idea that is everybody is drumming and there's a kind of ring of fire around the orchestra in a sense.
I want to ask about this percussion collective group that you're working with, because I'm guessing only four of them are actually playing in the percussion quartet part, but they're a lot bigger than that. Tell us how that percussion quartet works and how you're working with them.
Right. You know, I taught at Peabody for a number of years in Baltimore, and have been teaching for the last, let's see, I guess 11 years at Yale. And the percussion instructor at both of those places is Robert Van Sice, who is a superstar solo marimbist for many years and has become one of the leading pedagogues of the percussion world. And one of the things he teaches actually at Peabody, Curtis, and at Yale. So he's got an incredibly wide reach. And he had this idea to form a professional kind of collective of all these people who he helped train over the years and have a kind of similar ethic and spirit. And so this group is something like 20 professional percussionists. They're out in the world and playing in some of the great orchestras and the great ensembles in the world. And for the quartet, they basically, all of the players learn the parts. So although my piece is being done by six orchestras, the quartet will rotate within that collective of 20 people. And at any one point, if somebody gets sick or something like that, one of the other players who has learned the part will come in. And that's the way they work. So the collective idea of everybody kind of being on the same page and being able to step in for each other and be able to make the same music together. And they're building slowly a repertory. I mean, they've only been around for a couple of years. So it's kind of exciting to be on the front end of that.
Right. You were very closely with Robert Spano, obviously, here in Aspen, but also in Atlanta. And can you say a little bit about him and what he is doing for the contemporary music scene? Because it seems like he's a very pivotal figure in that these days.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, I almost, we'd need a 10-hour segment, I think.
Right.
No, really. I mean, he's a kind of a patient superhero, I would say, and with great sense of strategy and what he's doing and kind of stick-to-it-ness that makes it possible. I mean, in the first place, he really stays with people he believes in and is trying to cultivate over time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, since 1999, 2000, when I first crossed paths with him, we've done, I don't know, half a dozen big projects, and he's done a number of my other pieces too on the side, the new pieces together. And so when he asked me to do something, it's the most exciting call I can get, because
right.
I'm like, yes, Robert, let's do this. I can take this as far as we can go, and I'm ready to go. And I know the players of the Atlanta Symphony. I know a lot of the players here now, of course, over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And so those commissions, those projects have a really personal interest for me. And I'm really excited to do them. And I'm excited to do most pieces that I do, but those ones really mean something to me. So he creates that kind of interest. And then secondly, he's a composer. He's a wonderful composer, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I think if I was a composer and a conductor and I was working with another composer, my tendency would be to tell them things that I thought compositionally. He always stays out of that and lets people find their way. And I think in a way it creates a safe environment for composers to create things. And, you know, just to give you some idea, when I did my symphony with him about 10 years ago now in 2009, he gave me 2 full orchestra rehearsals earlier in the year to come read things in progress so I could kind of sculpt it. So he really cares about what comes out on the other end. It's not just the glory of having a premiere or something like that. I mean, he wants you to feel good about what you're putting out there. And then on top of it, of course, he does all these recordings, which are such an incredible thing for a composer to have. I mean, we don't have a lot of opportunities for orchestra recordings.
Chris, I want to thank you so much for your time and coming in. I know you're a busy man here.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for the opportunity.
It's wonderful to talk to you and catch up with what's happening at Aspen and also what's happening in your life as a composer.
Great. Many thanks.
We've been talking with composer Christopher Theofanidis about his upcoming Sunday performance of his own drum circles. Next, we catch up with both harpist Nancy Allen and oboist Elaine Duvas, who play a rarely heard Martin concerto on tonight's concert. Well, I was thinking about how to handle an interview between an oboist and a harpist who are playing together, and I thought I would just start with the oboist. So, Elaine, thank you for making it into Aspen Public Radio. And as you mentioned very briefly when you were just doing your sound check there, you were also the principal oboist of the Metropolitan Opera.
Yes.
And that gives you many, many chances to play wailing, sad, romantic, despairing, dolorous music, doesn't it?
Yes.
It's a great instrument for that. When you're up here in Aspen, do you have to fashion a different kind of reed? Does the altitude affect your reed making yourself?
The altitude has a major effect, and
wow.
You do have to start over. But we make fresh reeds practically daily anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You just can't expect the sea level ones to work at high altitude. The low notes wouldn't come out. It would be very, very sharp and unvibrant. So you have to scrape a lot more and make sure that the reed won't just close up and collapse.
Right. When you come up here, do you get to do more orchestral and chamber music teaching and work than you do during the regular season?
And
how is that different for you? You know, not
well, my regular season is taken up quite thoroughly by the opera. We have
sure.
a very heavy schedule. It's hard to work in extra things.
Right.
So, yes, I really enjoy a chance to play the symphonic repertoire. And I enjoy my teaching so much that I try to keep the chamber music at a minimum.
Well, let's jump over to Nancy. I'll talk to you for just a couple minutes. And again, this evening, the two of them are playing together, which is why eventually we're going to be talking about that piece as well. But you are with the New York Philharmonic, so you primarily are playing orchestral music. But then you're also the head of music departments in several different conservatories. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the basics so that people know where you teach and where you work besides the Phil?
Well, like most of us here, most of the faculty members, we wear many hats.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been here in Aspen with a festival. I first came in 1974, which is hard to believe.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got the position as a teacher here shortly thereafter. I teach at Juilliard School. I've taught at Juilliard for over 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my major position besides the New York Philharmonic, which would be my major position because
right.
it takes up most of my time. But I would say it's equally divided between the two. I also teach at Stony Brook University now. Yeah, I have to do all of those things. And like Elaine, I also play chamber music and solo works as much as I can.
Since I asked her about her reed making, is the process of tuning, does it take longer at high elevation, or is the humidity, or are there any things that make it more challenging to play at altitude and at humidity the way
well,
we have it here?
The overall subject of tuning is a very personal subject for
mm-hmm.
everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And they always say a harpist spends half their life tuning the instrument, the other half playing out of tune. But I'll tell you a secret, and that is that I started not only as a harpist, but I actually started as an oboist. And I was one of those oboe players until I was 18 years old who wasn't good enough to make reeds. So I'm one of those.
So you were sitting there on my first question going, oh, my God,
yeah,
that's
oh
me.
Oh, my God, yeah. I play the oboe in high school, you know, in typical public high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought my reeds. And I had a knife and I shaved them down, and I learned to make them, but I was useless. I can't even darn a sweater or a sock or a shirt.
Mm-hmm.
I can't sew. On the harp, we have pedal felts, which are wrapped around each of the seven pedals. This is the major mechanical section of our instrument, 2,000 moving parts in the upper area of the instrument, and seven pedals with 21 positions at the bottom. And that needs to be seamlessly quiet. For that reason, we have felts wound around each pedal, and they have to be sewn or glued. So I did have a lot of experience sewing pedal felts over the years, especially
mm-hmm.
in Aspen with all my students' harps arriving.
Mm-hmm.
But tuning is a different story. It's the same tuning. I will say the arid climate here is easier, actually,
mm-hmm.
for tuning in the cool weather and lack of humidity. Humidity wreaks havoc on gut strings, and that's what I play on.
Oh, okay.
So gut is really vulnerable to
mm-hmm.
weather and humidity changes. For example, last week's concert in the Festival Orchestra, we went from a bright, sunny, hot day to a completely enveloped by a storm with rain falling through the rest of the concert. And those kinds of things affect the harp strings, and I'm sure the reeds as well.
Mm-hmm.
But we're so used to it here that we plan for anything, and we tune a little higher so that we know the strings will adjust. It's a labor of love.
I want to bring the two of you finally together to talk. Tell us a little bit about this piece that the two of you get to work on together, which is a great thing, because you're obviously friends, I can tell that.
Well, Frank Martin wrote this concerto for Heinz Alger and his wife when he was about 80 years old. So it dates from 1970, and it's called Three Dances. He was inspired by his daughter, who was a successful flamenco dancer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got very strong rhythm. It sounds edgy and exotic. What would you say?
I think that this work is quite eclectic in a way. It combines styles of our playing, of the instrument's capabilities, and it also tries to project this dance feeling in the two outer movements, flamenco and the rumba in the last movement. The second movement reminds me of Bartok immensely. It reminds me of strings, percussion, and celeste, the way the harp is playing two octaves apart in unison. These kinds of lines are reminiscent of that music I know. But the inner movement is called Solitude, and it's very sparse. It's not the kind of music that makes you jump out of your seat in any case. It's edgy, it's rhythmic, it's harsh sometimes. He pushes the ranges of the instruments. Elaine's playing the tippy-top range of the oboe, and I am also playing a lot of the time at the top octave of the instrument, which is abrasive, and I'm not going to hide it, and I'm not going to try and make it sound heavenly. But the melodies are quite beautiful and cool.
And sometimes they're literally 12 tone rows, and yet you're not aware of that. It just sounds like a very unpredictable, satisfying dissonance in the melody.
Interesting.
But it frequently derives from the fact that he's using all 12 semitones in a row before repeating anything.
But generally, it seems like it comes back to a tonal.
Sounds like melodies.
So it does sound like melodies. Well, Bach wrote a 12 tone row too, so. Yeah, I think he was the first. But anyway, well, we are really looking forward to hearing this. And if anyone is not familiar with the music of Frank Martin, I strongly recommend you go. That concert also includes the music of Mozart, one of his later symphonies, the number 39, and the Schumann Violin Concerto with Midori. So we have actually three different soloists, one all by yourself and then the two of you together. So thank you for coming into Aspen Public Radio between all the lessons you're giving and everything else you have to do. Two friends, harpist Nancy Allen and oboist Elaine Duvas, play a rarely heard Martin concerto on tonight's concert. Finally, let's talk with violinist Stefan Jakiv, a well-known soloist here in Aspen and also a member of the Junction Trio, which comes to Aspen this Tuesday for a recital. Stefan, this is pretty amazing that the Aspen Music Festival has invited you here twice in the summer, once in July for the Barber, and then now as part of the Junction Trio. This is unusual. They must be very, very happy to have you coming back to invite you twice.
Well, I'm happy. I love coming here, so I'm thrilled that I get to come not once, but twice to beautiful Aspen.
And this time, when you're coming with Conrad Tau and the Junction Trio, tell us a little bit about the cellist. I think we know Conrad more than we know the cellist in your trio.
The cellist in our trio is Jay Campbell, who actually a couple days after our trio concert will be giving a solo recital in Harris Hall. Jay's one of the most thoughtful, interesting, kind of versatile musicians I know. I first met Jay about 5 years ago. We were on a chamber music tour of South Korea together, performing Schubert's Great Cello Quintet. And I really fell in love with his playing and felt that we needed to keep playing together. So when we came back to New York, where we both live, I suggested, why don't we call up Conrad Tau and read through some piano trios, which we did in Conrad's apartment. And that's how our trio was formed. And what I, you know, Jay and Conrad are obviously two very different people. But one thing that I think they share in common is sort of a deep curiosity about old music and new music. And they approach new music with the rigor that they approach old music, and they approach old music with the same sort of sense of discovery and freshness that they approach new music. And that's something that has really inspired me.
I wanted to ask you about that because I see the three of you as not only bridging the gap with new music and the old music, the Beethoven that you'll be playing, for example, but also new technology and old technology. I mean, a violin is about as old tech as you can get, and requires an enormous amount of discipline and work before you get very much satisfaction out of it. On the other hand, you and all the people of your generation are tied in with the internet and with advanced technologies in ways that other generations couldn't even imagine. I wonder if you see any special challenges as a young man with a violin in your hand. In a sense, how do you interface with the modern technology that tends to be much more quick and very, very different in its approach?
People sometimes talk about reminding society of the relevance, of the continued relevance of classical music. But I don't see it as relevance. I think music and really all great art is part of our humanity and our shared human experience. And I think in very special situations, it has the capacity to kind of make us feel understood and not alone, recognizing shared emotions and shared experiences with people either who are sitting next to us in a performance or with a composer who wrote a work hundreds of years ago. That sense of comfort and sense of belonging and sense of understanding and seeing yourself in another, I don't think is something that goes in and out of relevance.
Mm-hmm.
I do think, though, that today's fast-paced technology provides great opportunities to sort of spread the gospel of mm-hmm. classical music, whether it's Instagram or Facebook or the way in which we can all hear music very easily now on YouTube and on Spotify. So I don't really see it as a struggle as someone who deals with music, some of which was written long ago, to sort of marry that or wed that with kind of dealing with Facebook and Instagram and modern technology. The two go very well together.
Mm-hmm.
And also, as a quote-unquote classical musician, I also play a lot of music that's written today. So that kind of shows that the principles of music never go in and out of relevance and never go mm-hmm. in and out of style. They kind of are reimagined and sort of redigested by each new generation, but sort of this idea of communication and creating a sense of belonging and shared emotional experience, that's timeless.
One of the things I love about classical music, too, is people can make up their own stories. They can kind of create a narrative around a pure piece. I think about The Barber that you performed last month. That slow movement, I'll never forget the violinist named Delana Jensen, who you may mm-hmm. or may not know, but yeah. She was playing it about, I think, 3 days before she gave birth to her child. And
wow.
I will never hear The Barber Violin Concerto without, and that slow movement especially, without thinking of the incredible sweetness and miraculousness of human birth. And
yeah.
That has nothing to do with what Barbara was thinking, I'm sure. But do you have any narratives that you have in your own mind that help you in your performance of works like The Barber or anything else like that?
I wouldn't say I have narratives in the sense of storylines, but I have very clear ideas for every phrase, sometimes even for a note, what emotion I'm trying to evoke. So it's not just sort of a haphazard quest for some sort of abstract beauty that I'm looking for. I kind of have ideas of kind of the trajectory of a piece, the dramatic tension in a piece. You know, whenever you play a great piece of music, there are so many possibilities that present themselves. So
mm-hmm.
necessarily when you're preparing it, you have to make decisions, decide that you're going to highlight certain things that you find interesting and kind of bring that to the foreground. Those decisions change each time you revisit a piece. But I have a very clear kind of mental and emotional mapping of the piece mm-hmm. in my mind.
Would that be a way of maybe describing how people can approach contemporary music? I mean, we have a Conrad Tau piece, a new piece coming out for this performance, and then the Beethoven Archduke. And when I think of the Archduke, I think of the melodies, the rhythms, the harmonies in a realm that's very familiar to most of us classical listeners. I have no idea what to expect with Conrad Tau's music or with much of the contemporary music. What are the things that hold together certain pieces of contemporary music, or how should listeners approach contemporary music so that they can follow its thread?
Well, I think great pieces of contemporary music share many of the same threads that great old masterpieces share,
mm-hmm.
obviously in a very different language, but a focus on different textures of sound, a clear dramatic arc, a evocative interplay between the instruments if it's for more than one instrument. With Conrad's music, one thing that I am always drawn to, especially as a violinist, is sort of like the incredibly fragile nature of his sonic texture that mm-hmm. he writes for the violin. Sort of there's an incredible vulnerability and, yeah, fragility, I think, beautiful fragility that I think is very special in his music. And as you mentioned, we're pairing it with the Archduke Trio, and that's not to say that the Archduke has the same fragility that Conrad's piece has, but
mm-hmm.
I think the Archduke also does experiment with texture and registral combinations that I think sort of reflect the same curiosity in Conrad and in Beethoven.
Well, Stefan, we are very much looking forward to your performance. Again, that's going to be the work that we all know, the Archduke Trio of Beethoven, But then also something by Conrad Tao. So that's a going to be quite the mystery. So thank you, Stefan. We look forward to seeing all three of you up on the stage.
Looking forward to it. Thanks for having me.
That was violinist Stefan Jakif, a soloist and also a member of the Junction Trio, and they come to Aspen this Tuesday for a recital. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly program exclusively on Aspen Public Radio, where we talk to the musicians, composers, conductors, and the movers and shakers from the Aspen Music Festival and School during the festival season, Fridays at 2:30 p.m. I'm your host, Chris Moore. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll tune in next week.